Well, today we begin a five-week jaunt through the book of James. It rarely makes anyone's list of favorite scripture books. It took 3 centuries of vigorous debate before the early church even decided to include it in the biblical canon of the New Testament. The Protestant reformer Martin Luther found the book of James so theologically problematic that he argued we would be better off throwing it on the scrap heap. He called it an epistle of straw and other epithets not suitable for this sermon. But here we are centuries later, still reading the book of James. I think there is good reason to find it problematic, even better reason to keep reading it. And I hope I've piqued your interest sufficiently with this preamble to hang with me and with this enigmatic book of James and see what gleanings there might be for us in our lives today and in this distressed world in which we live. So first, it's not really a book at all. It's not even really a letter or an epistle in the same way that Paul wrote letters to church communities across the empire. James is more of a rambling blog to anyone who will listen. He has ethical wisdom here and exhortations to his readers to behave a certain way because of who you are as Christians. Be doers of the word, not merely hearers. We read this morning as part of an opening volley that says, what you do in life matters. It's analogous to the famous quote from St. Francis, proclaim the gospel at all times, use words when necessary. James will go on to address what being doers of the word looks like and why it's important, not just out there, but for us individually on our spiritual journeys as well. What we say matters also. And James argues that the human tongue is a small organ with a huge capacity for good and a huge capacity for evil. It reminds me of that ditty, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me. That's a lie, friends. That's an insidious lie. Words can and do hurt. And James says, be mindful of the power of the tongue and use it for good. And then he speaks of suffering and the very real human experience that suffering is. There are universal themes in the arc of James' writings, but they are embedded with a certain particularity. He was writing to Palestinian Christians about 30 years after Jesus died and on the eve of the Romans seizing and laying waste to Jerusalem and killing, slaughtering thousands of its citizens and destroying the beloved temple in the year 70 CE. Persecutions in the time in which James is writing were very real. Civil unrest was on the rise. There were disagreements among the leaders in this new Christian sect. The future was not at all clear. Suffering was one's daily companion among the early Christians. And James speaks into that moral fog as thick as pea soup to say, be doers of the word. And then he says, true religion is this, care for the orphans and widows and keep oneself unstained by the world. Now that's going to need some unpacking too, but at this point, let's note that it is not one or the other, but both caring for those in need and embracing a way of spiritual life for oneself. The phrase, care for orphan and widow, is an oft-used and readily accessible biblical proxy for obedience to the law, the fullness of the law, which paradoxically, James says, is a law of liberty. Because in abiding by it, we unfold into a spiritual freedom. Elsewhere, James will use a more familiar proxy: love God and love your neighbor as yourself. Surely we can see the wisdom and a certain freedom in that. But then there's this second part of the charge, to keep oneself unstained by the world. This is not an outward action of caring for others, but the inward spiritual work that must be engaged to remain grounded, centered, oriented to what is important. It's the spiritual contemplation, the prayers and practices that inform the action. And so it's contemplation and action. Two sides of the Christian identity card. One without the other makes no sense to us. Now, to be clear, Christians don't have a corner on that notion. And I would suggest to you that all true religions have some version of this two-pronged expression of the spiritual journey. Contemplation and action are both needed. And that's what James is saying. But speaking now as a Christian to Christians, let me say this. We do not do the work of justice because the world needs us to, or to make the world a better place. Those are penultimate reasons. Not bad, hear me, not bad, but they are not primary for us. And when they become primary or detached from the contemplative side of Christian living, we risk falling into the trap of a form of self-idolatry, a self-importance that will stifle the gift of compassion which we have to share. As Christians, we do the work of justice because our inner life oriented to God calls us into relationship grounded in the goodness with which we have been seated. We are beloved. That's why we act. We are created for love. We are created to love. That's the source of our action. The contemplative practices of Christianity exist to help us recognize our true identity, especially when the wiles of the world have blown us off course and we become lost. In that seminal story of Adam and Eve in the garden in the book of Genesis, when they have hidden themselves in fear or shame or simply because they become spiritually lost, we all know those realities. The story suggests that God calls out to them, "Where are you, Adam? Where are you, Eve?" Of course, this is the story of all humanity. It is your story, it's my story, because we all know the experiences of lostness, of fear, of shame. In our traditional rendering of the Genesis story, we often hear it as an angry God calling out Adam and Eve for their original sin. Where are you? But the Hebrew word translated as "where are you" is actually ayekah. Ayekah, which more accurately is translated, "Who are you? And where do you stand in this world?" Ayekah is an inquiry of inner truth and outward expression all at once. Ayekah is analogous to the charge James delivers us this morning. My friends, I know the moral arc of our world seems in the present time to be flapping violently in all directions rather than bending decidedly toward justice. The litany of lament and suffering grows longer each day, and we struggle to make sense of the suffering in Afghanistan and in Haiti and in hospital ICUs. Floods, fires, and hurricanes take their toll on humans, on creation, and on our weary hearts. It's all a lot. There are no easy solutions. And it seems to me that the moral fog is as thick in our time now as it was for those to whom James was writing 20 centuries ago. In such difficult times, I am convinced that the inner work becomes all the more important for us as we seek to ground ourselves in that beloved identity from which all good things flow, including any acts of goodwill we have to share in the world. Every generous act of giving comes from God, James says. And trusting that, we can become doers of the word, free to be who we were created to be and do what we were created to do. Taking the long view, friends, I remain fervently hopeful that the arc of the moral universe does indeed bend toward justice, and that God is in the midst of all of this and is eternally calling Ayeka to each and every one of us, not to chastise us when we fall short, but as a yearning for us to live fully into that way of being in the world and know ourselves to be who we truly are. Our work is to lean into that relationship with God as the bedrock for any action we might take to ease the pain and suffering of the world. So I would ask you this morning, what does that look like for you? Focus there first, and then you will surely find your way.